Any questions or?
Oh, I guess I really liked your talk, but it made me wonder, I guess in reading groups I've been in, they sort of focused on the whole idea of the sort of even the linguistic problems of, we're saying, the structure of the human mind or something, when in any given historical moment, it's sort of just an accumulation of the present theories. And so I guess my question is, do you run up against in your work the question of to what extent, in some ways, the science is actually almost a little behind the state of society in terms of things being theory laden, or in terms of like someone like Thomas Kuhn or paradigm shifts and stuff? I mean, do you feel like that makes it more complicated to try to make links between science and humanities, because there's such a weird, complicated relationship between like the production of scientific theory and what's actually available as avenues of experimentation and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a problem, because science is, especially academic science and, you know, especially cognitive science, is basically an outgrowth of the military-industrial complex. That's obvious, you know. All my grant money comes with the Department of Defense, which sort of puts me in some ethical positions occasionally, but I don't think anything useful will come out of any of the stuff I do, so I just take the money and run. But, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some influence on how science works, upon what's a hot topic, what society, what the DOD wants, what the government wants, what the military wants. But nonetheless, you know, when you investigate a topic through whatever means, if the science, you know, the government can't sort of, if you're actually doing, you know, empirical work and you aren't falsifying results, the government can't say, well, you know, I'd much rather have the human mind be this really easy thing to figure out so we can brainwash everyone really quickly, you know. If the empirical results point to his human mind being very complex, then, you know, it's very complex. And you can only falsify. I think the central structure of how science works is definitely influenced by society. And that's why the philosophy of the mind is so separated from, like, political philosophy right now. But only so much. It can't change the essential nature of what's being discovered. It may change, sort of provide impetus to go in one particular way or another by providing dangling money. But it won't change the essential, you know, nature of the scientific enterprise.
It is a really interesting talk. I'm fascinated by this topic. A couple of obvious questions I'll just throw out. One is, is it enough to say that the human brain is not organized the way that hierarchical societies have taught us it is, in the sense that they're projecting onto the human brain the social structures of those hierarchical societies, and to suggest then that if it's organized in a different way, that's going to solve the broad range of the problems we're faced with. I mean, think about it this way. Capitalist democracy, let's call it capitalist multi-party whatever, is very rhizomatic compared to monarchy, right? But it's in many ways reinforces and embeds more deeply the structures of power that make it more difficult to relieve ourselves of the burden of them than monarchy did. Monarchy was relatively easy to overthrow compared to this. And then secondly, there's an is-ought problem. I mean, even if we can make the analogy between our prior spurious understandings of the way the human mind works and our flawed understandings of the way human beings are, that still doesn't answer a lot of the big questions. You know, I mean, is violence appropriate in getting there? Are gender relations more important than other kinds of liberation? Those sorts of questions that have to do with moral and ethical issues that may not be reducible to brain structure in the same way that empirical and ontological questions are.
I mean, the questions that I went over very briefly in the talks, just language and number, are really easy to go into from a sort of scientific perspective, because there has been scientific work on those questions. You know, sort of more complicated questions is, you know, should nonviolence be used or not? I mean, the metaphors only go so far before they break. I think it's a mistake, actually, in a lot of political philosophy to think that their metaphors can go on forever. For example, you know, the metaphors of green anarchism can often be looked upon as sort of a renewing of the fall from grace sort of look at the world, while the metaphors of social ecology can be thought of as more like, well, we have sort of rephrased leftism in terms of ecological thinking. And I think, what this is pointing out, if nothing else, is that our metaphors can be extremely fluid and extremely flexible. And the mind may be useful, especially in questions like involving time and number and language, in answering basic questions that are directly pertinent to it and providing some sort of metaphorical insight. But probably not entirely that relevant to, should I use nonviolence in D.C. and the IMF, I mean, that's very much dependent upon the particular situation at hand. I mean, the one thing I would have to say is that there has been lots of interaction between sort of looking at the mind. The one really interesting attempt to look at the mind in terms of sort of capitalism and social Darwinism has been a fellow named Edelman made a claim of neural Darwinism, that the neurons fight each other to survive, and they sort of had to go through this Darwinistic process of natural selection, which is honestly not really that much heavily supported. There is definitely, your behavior is definitely related to your survival, but the neurons don't go through a bloody evolutionary struggle every time a human being's born. It seems to be more programmatic given certain inputs at certain stages in development. The one thing I could definitely say about sort of larger theoretical questions is that, if you abandon sort of all ideologies and all ideals that you hold be perfect and absolute, then you gain a lot of flexibility and diversity in your tactics. And that since most modern philosophy and modern cognitive science points towards ideals sort of in the grand sense of the capital I word being not really existing anywhere except our own minds, then we can definitely, I think, embrace the diversity of tactics depending on the situation.
Just follow up, that's sort of the point I was getting at then. Isn't it suggesting then that built into this ontology is a diversity of tactics, but that isn't that the major debate we're engaged in right now about whether a real diversity of tactics, including property damage and maybe even violence down the road, is appropriate or not? Can we really get at those sorts of questions with the neuroscience issues?
Well, they can just lead you down the road where you say you might be open to debate on the issue.
Yeah, I think any attempt to use scientific principles to address social questions has the built-in danger of reductionism, because a lot of modern science is inherently reductionist in the way it's done, and things don't apply as literally as people would sometimes like to think. The way we try to deal with that problem here in social ecology, because we look a lot at evolution as a source of wisdom about society. We look at every year we have big debates about the question of, does natural evolution give us an objective ground for our political ethics? And the way we try to approach it is by, as you were suggesting, by thinking more in terms of tendencies, of potentialities within the patterns of nature, rather than falling into the kind of trap that the social Darwinists, of course, are more guilty of than anybody else, of thinking that what we're able to observe from natural phenomena is deterministic in any way on what happens socially. The question I wanted to ask is more in the realm of kind of structural neuroscience in a way. When I was doing work in the neurosciences 20 years ago, one of the perceptions that was just starting to become accepted that I found interesting politically was the role of, I'm trying to remember how to say it right, the role of local circuitry in the central nervous system. The way people are generally taught about the nervous system at the beginning is in terms of the patterns of the peripheral nervous system, where impulses travel long distances, and neural events can be described as all or none phenomena, where, you know, either a neuron fires or it doesn't, depending on the kinds of signals going into it. And it was becoming clearer at that time, 20 years ago, that that's not the way things work in the central nervous system. Things work much more by gradations, by phenomena that matter at the level of local circuitries in involved in particular. I haven't thought about this stuff in a long time, so the language is not coming out clearly. But the phenomenon of local circuitry and of I forget the term, but the opposite of all or none signaling.
Sort of more continuous firing as opposed to discrete firing.
Yeah, and I'm just curious. I mean, how far those kinds of discussions have proceeded in the last 20 years since I've really followed this stuff.
That's sort of the main resemblance, the main anti-hierarchical nature of the brain is the fact that, you know, it's there's definitely a process, it's definitely a flow, but there's not a strict hierarchy. That what you generally have is you have lots of, for example, when you see something, you know, the illusion you have, you know, when you're seeing TV, you're seeing motion. That's definitely an illusion. If anything's good evidence against objectivism, that's one of them. You know, when the impulses of light come into your eyes, they actually get separated out by various autonomous nervous systems. So you have one that processes color, you know, one that helps process motion, one that processes sort of, you know, light and dark tendencies, various tendencies within vision. And it's actually really interesting because this particular type of damage, you can have a particular damage to color and, you know, thus sort of be colorblind neurally, not only sort of the retina. And one could have damage to motion, and it's akinetopsia, and not be able to perceive everything seems like discrete moments, you know, not very continuous. But that essentially what happens is these localized systems, through sharing information, sort of continuously build up the beautiful image that you see. And that's not a very discrete process. On a biological level, though, you know, neuron firing is definitely sort of, the firing of a neuron is discrete. So you either do something or you don't, you know. But sort of from a broad human standpoint, where you're a human, you're thinking about whether you should drink that coffee in the morning or not, you know, and you feel like, you know, various parts of your body, the neuron clusters firing sort of actually compete. And they have a model of this, which they call a competition network, and, you know, one wins. So what you see in your behavior is sort of just a very thin layer, almost, I think, maybe, you know, a little tiny glacier or current upon the great depths of all the various, you know, neural firings which are going on, and possibilities and options which basically are competing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean,
and so that's the importance of localism, the importance of doing things, of autonomy, is of prime importance now. It's perhaps the central tendency in cognitive neuroscience, and the sort of the big gambit is how does it all fit together, and, you know, how does consciousness come about? That's sort of one of the big gambits, and a lot of philosophers of the mind, take a fellow named Daniel Dennett, have basically thought, well, you know, if all the parts interact correctly, then the sort of holism we have of being a human walking around the world and it seems to all flow so fluidly and perfectly, and we call that consciousness, that that is simply the net result of having a bunch of parts functioning together well. And that's not like a separate subunit, so you don't have a consciousness unit somewhere, you know.
20 years ago, what people were starting to find evidence for, and maybe it hasn't panned out, was that in the central nervous system, which is the core circuitry of the brain as opposed to the periphery, that there were clusters of neurons that were appearing to function in more of an analog mode that weren't all or none firing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's also, I mean, it's a sigmoid mostly. Usually the firing is consistent. It's thought of mathematically as a sort of a, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of a gray area in between, which is definitely could be considered sort of analog.
But this was even more in that direction. That the idea was that there were neurons that didn't fit
a discrete firing
pattern at all.
Well, that's the whole thing. It's also like many different types of neurons can evolve different ways. And I know for example, pyramidal cells sort of have a more sort of sigmoid function, but other ones don't. It depends where you are. And what's really interesting is that I think hopefully like as anarchists we believe humans can be reconstructed in a number of ways, and we can influence our environment to produce different types of, you know, we don't have to be competitive jerks in a market system. So do neurons. If you're, you know, for example, if you're a blind person, the neurons used in the occipital lobe, which process vision, actually start getting taken over and start activating during braille processing, which involves touch, which is a very controversial but more or less seems to be a pretty concrete finding.
Wow.
I saw some other hands.
Yeah. I guess I have a statement and then a question. The statement is that I'm not sure about the idea of grounding our political and social philosophies in natural systems, because there are a lot of different ones out there, and both competition and cooperation and both hierarchy and non-hierarchical relationships exist in nature on a lot of different levels, and it seems like people tend to go out and find proofs of what they're looking for. And I'm not sure, like, even if our brain was hierarchical, should our social systems be? Or just because a lot of social systems have been hierarchical or are in some primate societies, does that mean that's what we should choose? It seems like we should actively choose what seems best, most fair, and healthiest for us, you know? And the fact that it's possible, even if a lot of other things are possible, is a good enough reason to do it. Then, my question is kind of unrelated. It's about analog computers. I've read about them being developed or researched, and I wanted to know if you had any information on that. I've heard they're a lot faster because they're not hierarchical, or they could be a lot faster because they don't have to go through all these, you know, 0-1 steps to get to.
That's a whole other giant field. But, as regards your first question or your first statement, I mean, my commentary would simply be that, I mean, that's why I tried to point out that this is just like, you know, anarchism for neuroscientists is just like anarchism for gardeners or, you know, anarchism for poets. That it's simply trying to take a body of knowledge or some type of human activity that normally is considered outside the vein of politics and try to see if there's any relationships or similarities or even ways it could be made useful. And I don't believe any type of sort of like Kropotkin's, you know, biological proofs of anarchism, you know, or Kropotkin-esque, because, you know, essentially when it comes down to it, you just have to, you could use it as a metaphor and as a tendency, as a way you may find interesting thoughts, but there's no determinism in politics, obviously. A lot of capitalist philosophy is based on a sort of evolutionary determinism. You start talking to people, well, you know, the world is rough and tough and we have to survive, and that clearly is not always the case, as the ISE is quite nice. As for analog computers, I'm not particularly well versed in it. Neural networks is where I do a lot of my work, and they basically try to simulate on a highly centralized digital computer, essentially, and more analog system, and it sends the digital hierarchical computer to a complete halt quite often. There is work on analog computers. A lot of it has to do with the fact that Moore's law, which is the law that every, you know, so many years, the amount of transistors in a chip and thus like the speed and whatnot will double or exponentially increase. We're coming to the point where that's no longer physically possible given the materials we have at hand. So there's a big race in the computer sciences to find some type of way to make faster and better computers. And they've been looking at various molecular computing. They've been looking at very interesting and quite beyond my grasp, quantum computing, and you know, where this stuff will lead to, it's kind of hard to say at this point. Any other questions or comments?
I was thinking that one of my favorite books, Critiques of Capitalism, is by a non-anarchist, John McMurtry, who's a Canadian philosopher guy. And he wrote a book called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. So the world's kind of healthy, and the problem is there's a kind of cancer, which is capitalism. And, you know, he's quite detailed about the metaphor. It's quite well done, I think. So I was just sort of thinking, well, when talking about kind of neural networks as a metaphor of anarchist society, to what extent would you say that, like, neurological diseases mirror the diseases or problems of contemporary society?
I actually haven't thought about it.
Because it's the obvious, I mean,
yeah.
the other side, you know, your sort of critique and proposal, in some sense. You know, the proposal bit is that, well, the neural networks represent an anarchist, you know, non-hierarchical society, so then there's the sort of critique bit, to me, is the other side of, you know, neurological diseases, maybe, mirror.
I mean, nothing jumps out right to mind, but I sort of a few obvious points, which is that, you know, in the human mind, that if you do have some, you know, if you do have some type of neurological damage, sometimes if you have enough redundant systems, it won't show up until, you know, it's far too until those all your redundant systems have been knocked out. And I think that this concept of redundancy is something we have to think about as anarchists and as someone who's critiquing capitalism, because I mean, capitalists often you can have a lot of redundancy built into how they manage the world. You know, you can escape the poll tax, but you can't escape another type of tax. You can escape one form of domination, you just fall into the laps of another. So the question is, what sort of, in the mind, to knock out a whole system, sometimes you have to have, sometimes damage to one area can send multiple areas into non-functioning status, but also sometimes damage, you can't see the damage until damage has been done to multiple areas, in which case the whole system runs out of redundancy and fails. So when you're thinking about, you know, maybe attacking capitalism, you can think about, well, what's the Achilles heel? The one part of the system which I knock off, everything will fall apart, you know. Is it the private financial sector? Is it, you know, what sector is it? Also, you could think about perhaps, you know.
Well, which sector is most lacking in redundancy?
Yeah, which sector is most lacking in redundancy?
From what you're saying,
These are all questions which I really don't know the answer to, but I'm sure with enough study it can be found.
Do you want to say a little bit more about the work that you're doing
And I mean, any other comments or questions? I thought you had your hand up a while ago.
Well, you mentioned different disciplines are sort of leaning in, and you connected the neuroscience to different disciplines, social sciences, etc. Has anyone touched upon it with, like, Eastern mysticism or yoga or something like that? It seems like it lends itself to thinking about yoga. I know a few people who are into yoga.
Not yoga. There's been a flurry. I mean, there is occasional flurries of activity as regards sort of, you know, Zen in the mind, and or, you know, sort of Eastern conceptions of, you know, the mind as the body, which, and these occasionally produce some work. I'm not really that familiar with it. But, I mean, I think that the premises, a lot of the premises of Western capitalism are built on sort of, you know, rampant idealism, you know, rampant dualism, rampant separation of the mind from the body, humans from the environment, and all these are shown to be quite false dichotomies by science. So if you have basically if your political philosophy is based on a bunch of false dichotomies, or you're trying to make a philosophy which is based on, as I think a lot of Zerzan, as much as I love his atmosphere, he invokes a lot of false dichotomies, then I think the political philosophy which comes out of that is doomed to failure. And I think that's a very important point. You can't create political philosophy in a nexus, a void, you know. And also you can't create it without realizing sort of what you're drawing your knowledge from. You know, social ecology draws a lot from ecological thinking, combined with sort of some leftist, classical leftism. And so you got to think, you know, what are my essential domains of knowledge that I'm using to create my political philosophy? How does that influence it? And why would maybe other people not understand social ecology? You know, why would social ecology not be popular maybe in a city I can use green anarchy as an example. Why does green anarchy work so well in the Northwest, but why would it not work in, say, New York City or Boston? Why would anarcho-syndicalism work very well in a sort of a society which is, you know, New York City or Boston, which has a lot of factories, lots of people, you know, who need some measure of control over their workplace, but not work very well with, you know, traveling train hopping kids who are trying to escape workplaces, the very idea of a workplace. You know, I kind of generally tend to believe that diversity of anarchist philosophy, based on as many possible metaphors and as many possible people, as many possible domains of knowledge, is a good thing. Other people don't agree.
I agree.
Is there any other questions or comments? I can talk a little bit about, there's definitely interesting questions as regards animal experimentation, which may be interesting to people. Animal experimentation is definitely used in neuroscience. In particular when, you know, for example, they're trying to figure out, you know, how neurons work, and if there's, you know, is there particular neurons which recognize, you know, this sort of a big controversy was something called the grandmother cell controversy, which, you know, do you have a particular cell in your brain which recognizes grandma when you see grandma, or do you have, you know, a network of cells, which is an ensemble was the phrase being used, which recognize grandma. And so they test this by, you know, displaying hands, you know, waving at monkeys, and then sticking needles in their heads to figure out what neurons lit up and were activated when hands were waved. And essentially, you know, they found different neurons worked, you know, some hands would recognize, you know, different, you certain neurons in the visual system of monkeys would specialize for different forms, like sort of more abstract forms, like vertical, horizontal, and that, you know, but eventually these would all work to discover hands in any of its many forms. But this, of course, led to probably lots of highly damaged monkeys. And, you know, this is a real ethical dilemma for scientists. I luckily avoid this because I generally do most of my work with normal humans and computers. And
how do the humans feel about it?
Normal humans are generally bored to death by the experiments we do, which involve, you know, flashing colors at them, making them read things. I think the worst thing we do is shoot infrared. In my laboratory, the worst thing we do is shoot infrared beams with their eyes to see how fast they're reading. But there is a lot of the central base
of
science.
How that works? How does an infrared beam tell you how fast someone's reading?
Okay, if anyone's interested, it's sort of a digression. But if you're reading, and there's an infrared beam coming at your eyes, and then your retina moves, and the infrared beam still coming at your eyes, and you're shooting a series of infrared beams and sort of tracking, you can sort of see how far the retina's moved, and then project where your retina's moved, which is pretty accurate describing, you know, how long have you been looking at this word, how long have you been looking at that word. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's sort of the general zeitgeist of it. I think one thing we have to remember in science is that it has been based on, especially in early neuroscience, was based more or less on wholesale butchery of animals. And this is a problem, you know. I mean, because some good has come, but has it outweighed the deaths of the animals? Has it outweighed the possible suffering of human subjects who are going through lots of experiments with questionable pharmaceutical drugs? Usually, I mean, a lot of neuroscience research is basically done by looking at damaged patients, people who have particular impairment, people who can't read, who are just fine, but they just can't read. Maybe it's, you know, neurological. You know, people who can't use grammar, people who can't see color, people who can't perceive motion, people who can't name objects. You know, someone can draw them, but they can't name them, and there's usually a particular neural impairment. And there's very few of these people. So a lot of research in neuroscience is based upon looking at these few people and extracting the results. So there's currently is a trend to sort of make artificial damage to people. You can inflict artificial damage on someone's brain by using magnetic lesions. Which will temporarily, supposedly they'll get better, damage sections of their brain. Would you rather have that, or would you rather have, animals having parts of their brain forcibly removed, or would you rather stop all the research altogether,
The other option that scientists have explored is to just not use animals, but use humans and butcher them. But one of the things you mentioned earlier made me remember an experiment. It was where they were finding out which parts of the speech mechanisms were connected to which parts of the brain, and where grammar is in the brain and things like that. They injected prisoners with salt water into different pieces of different locations in the brain, and plenty of these guys died. I meant to ask you if you know where the actual experiments were written up. I never was able to find the article. I was just here from a couple of different linguists mentioned, oh yeah, there was this prisoner who's getting shot with salt water to find the grammar, something like that.
I could possibly help finagle those. I don't know off the top of my head. I've heard of that. As regards sort of like treatment for subjects, there's been a wave of controversy recently. In medical science, a few subjects have died because of improper procedure by an experienced scientist. So it's still definitely a problem. As regards the whole question of where's grammar in the brain, grammar is the really interesting one, because grammar is this highly structured, ordered system that would seemingly definitely be sort of hierarchical, or definitely a sign of human uniqueness. And it's basically shown to be an evolutionary developed instinct. And in a lot of the work they using this is basically just empirical evidence, looking at kids who haven't developed language, looking at people who have language impairments, scanning people. What I do, scan people's brains while they read, and see what particular electrical impulses or can be discovered through that. One particularly interesting experiment is that if someone has a language and they're reading and they discover and there's a syntax problem in a language, there's a particular configuration of neuron firings. And if there's a semantic error, so my mom ate the bucket, there's another distinct neuron firing pattern. These firing patterns haven't been localized anywhere yet, but they're probably where the rest of the language is. There's all sorts of, it's sort of interesting. I see what's happening in political philosophy. Essentially, what anarchism is trying to do is trying to take whole host. There's lots of sort of separate traditions, everything from sort of classical revolutionary traditions, syndicalism and whatnot, to more ecological thinking, and collapse them into a more holistic, philosophy of politics. And this is exactly what's happening in cognitive science, is you have lots of people who study the mind in different ways having their philosophies collapse. And we only have 5 more minutes, so. Is there any other questions, or? Deafening silence. If anyone's interested, I'd be happy to correspond on the subject. I have a paper I've written up. If you want to give me your email, I'll email it to you. I think the real take-home lesson from this is that, we all know different parts. We all have different various specializations, and we have to, be very open into what anarchism can be applied in and what we can take out and apply to anarchism. And that, if there's anything to take home from neuroscience and from cognitive science, is that, the mind definitely doesn't predestine us towards living in a capitalist society, and that we have a mind which essentially works fairly well on principles which can be, with a poetic leap, termed anarchism, termed anarchist at least, and then maybe that would provide us some measure of hope. That's really about it. I hope everyone enjoyed the talk.